From Wyoming to Alabama, Oklahoma to Vermont, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Project 2025 is set to offer policy and personnel to the next conservative presidential administration. This has drawn fire from the left. Steve Groves from the Heritage Foundation is here to set the record straight. While Democrats debate whether or not to keep Joe Biden as their nominee, speculation over who will be Donald Trump's running mate is at a fever pitch. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The federal government now wants to put RFID chips in every cow in the country. And that's no bull. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Jared Dieterol of the R Street Institute. And this year, artificial intelligence may be the biggest threat to democracy. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Project 2025 has assembled policy recommendations and is screening potential staff for the next conservative presidential administration. The goal is to wrest control of the executive branch from the deep state. As might be expected, the left has gone into meltdown over the project. Here with details is Steve Groves. Steve is the Margaret Thatcher Fellow in the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom at the Heritage Foundation. Steve, welcome to American Radio Journal. Steve, there has been a lot of news coverage, a lot of it not accurate or fair, of course, from the legacy news media about Project 2025. So you have, in fact, helped write portions of it. Tell our audience, what is Project 2025?
It's a multi-year project that the Heritage Foundation has led, but we're leading a large coalition of other conservative organizations and activist groups. I think our advisory board tops 110 different conservative organizations. We all coalesced together a couple of years ago for the purpose of providing policy recommendations and personnel recommendations to the next conservative president. And so that's how the project started out, even before the primary season began. So we decided to first put all of our ideas down on paper, and that led to a very thick book that's available for sale if any of your listeners are interested in our exact policy proposals. And then we also wanted to recruit people from around the country who were ready, willing, and able to serve in the next conservative administration and have them put their information through our system so that we could review them and vet them and meet them even so that we can make recommendations to the next conservative administration, which it's turning out to be former President Donald Trump. And so we hope once the convention is over and the transition period the planning period begins, to be able to make these recommendations to President Trump and his campaign team.
So planning for a presidential transition and organizations and various groups, you mentioned 110 of them, working on policies they would like to see the federal government implement. How is it that somehow this has been cast as being nefarious by the left? It would seem to me to be just normal, prudent planning.
The issue is the conservatives have coalesced. Now we've started to do what the left does every 4 years. They're much better at this type of coalition building and planning and scheming than we as conservatives are. They're just more organized in that way because they dominate academics. They dominate the think tanks. For every Heritage Foundation out there, there's a score of liberal think tanks thinking about what's going to happen in the next administration. So the left and the media see what we're doing, and frankly, they're getting very concerned that when President Trump wins election again, that there's not going to be chaos, there's not going to be disorder, that there's going to be a thousands and thousands of allies of the president's ready, willing, and able to step in and help him implement his agenda. So what the left does with the complete complicity of the media is they'll lie about this project. They'll make up a bunch of false recommendations that we've never made before, and then attack the project and try to hang it around the president's head. You know, this is when they attack Project 2025, they're attacking Donald Trump because they think that in attacking the president's allies, that they can harm the president. And it's just simply not the case. And we're going to fight back their false accusations. And good will win out here because their accusations are baseless. And we're prepared to defend what we've done with this project.
The left, of course, places a lot of attention, a lot of interest, of course, in the deep state, the bureaucracy. Tell us a little bit, Steve, about how important it is for a presidential administration to be able to actually effectuate change in the deep state and not just at the top policy level.
Well, of course, and you've touched on something there as well, why they're coming after the project, because the project's coming after them. They should be afraid. The deep state, the permanent federal bureaucracy that vote overwhelmingly in favor of Democrat candidates and liberal and leftist candidates, one of the reasons that they attack the project is we're going after them. And we'll make recommendations to the president that the president is already amenable to. At near the end of his first administration, he did something called Schedule F, what was not able to implement it because it was at the end of the administration. So what Schedule F does is it makes a bunch of federal bureaucrats who are in positions of power and positions of authority, but they're not political appointees, it makes them no longer protected by the civil service rules. And they can, if they don't follow the president's agenda, they can be removed from their position, either transferred or fired or demoted. What we want to avoid in the next Trump administration is the deep state blocking the president's agenda, slow rolling the president's agenda, and putting up obstacles. There was too much of that between 2017 and 2020. So one of our recommendations, which the president is already amenable to, is to do something called Schedule F, where we reclassify several thousands and thousands of these deep state folks with the purpose of having them implement the president's agenda rather than block it.
With the recent decision by the Supreme Court of the United States in the Chevron case here, Steve, is it ever more important that the deep state, the bureaucracy, actually be brought into line in terms of being responsive to the will of the president, elected by the people, and the will of Congress, also elected by we the people?
Yes, we're big fans of the overruling and the overturning of the Chevron doctrine. It returns the real authority for making laws back to where it belongs under the Constitution, which is our Article I branch of government, Congress. Congress, for too long, has passed laws and just allowed the federal bureaucracy, the executive branch, to work out all the details and have discretion, way too much discretion, about how to work out those details. And what happens is you have federal agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency way overreaching based on federal legislation like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, and deciding things like carbon dioxide is a pollutant. Well, Congress never passed any law saying carbon dioxide was a pollutant, but the EPA has made that finding on their own.
Steve Groves is the Margaret Thatcher Fellow in the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom at the Heritage Foundation. We've been talking about Project 2025, a project to assist with the presidential transition that will occur in January of next year. Steve, tell us a little bit about Heritage. Also, you referenced the fact Project 2025, a lot of policy material there. Where can folks find that on the web? How can they get more information on Project 2025?
Everything you'll want to know about the project is available at project2025.org. That's project2025.org. This project and all the rest of Heritage's work, research, and other products are available at heritage.org.
Steve Groves of the Heritage Foundation. Steve, thank you for taking time to be with us.
I appreciate you having me on.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, like the rest of us, keeping an eye out to see who is going to be Donald Trump's running mate. Scott, good to have you here.
Well, it's great to be back, Loman. Thank you.
I will mention, most folks who are listening to us, Scott, are probably hearing us on Saturday or Sunday, and we did record the show on Thursday, so it's possible Donald might have made his announcement by the time folks hear this, but nonetheless, we're going to talk about some of the potentials, and potentially we won't have an announcement until the Republican National Convention gets underway on Monday. But your thoughts on who the leading contenders are here to be Donald Trump's running mate in 2024?
Bottom line is that these Republicans have a deep, deep bench on people that could do the position. We've seen it all the way back to 2016 when we had 17 candidates running for president. And obviously, it was a smaller number with Trump and Ramaswamy and others that ran here for the 2024 nomination. Trump blew them all away. He became the presumptive nominee really right after Iowa. And he's got a long list of people that I think, number one, could serve as VP or also serve in an important role in the cabinet. Right at the top of the list, it seems like there's momentum behind Senator J.D. Vance from Ohio. Trump was asked about some comments that, oh, he doesn't like guys with beards. And this week when he did an interview with Fox, he said, well, you know, J.D. Vance has sort of a young Abraham Lincoln look to him. And I think that's a big compliment because everybody that knows Trump, he views himself in the same sort of status as people like Abraham Lincoln. And so for him to pass along a compliment like that to J.D. Vance, I think is telling. I would certainly put him right near the top of the list. Governor Burgum from North Dakota continues to sort of be somebody that's talked about. And Burgum also has experience on energy and commerce issues. I think he could find himself in the cabinet, even if he's not selected as the running mate. He's been a big surrogate, helped raise money for the president. And, you know, I think that Trump has a mutual respect sort of for the so-called billionaires club. Then you look at others and you've got Governor Youngkin in the Commonwealth of Virginia here. Youngkin is, again, somebody that could expand the electoral map and bring another state into play for Trump. Trump wants to win big to avoid the rig. And Governor Youngkin has a lot of respect from the business community. He's been an excellent governor, and I think he's somebody that should be considered. You can keep moving down the list. They did a big rally this week in Miami, and he was toying with Marco Rubio a little bit. I think Senator Rubio would be an excellent Secretary of State in the Trump cabinet. If he selects somebody from Florida, you have the constitutional issue where the state's electors can't support somebody and vote for them at the Electoral College if they're from the same state. So you would need to see some sort of a residency resolution there between Marco Rubio and Donald Trump. Same thing goes for rising stars like Byron Donalds, who also is from Florida. And I think it's a good problem to have, but ultimately those guys could find themselves in really important cabinet positions supporting the president's agenda and helping build upon the electoral mandate that we are trying to grow right now heading into November 5th.
And less than 4 months to the election, it's far better for all the speculation to be about who's going to be your running mate than whether or not your presumptive nominee is stable enough to stay on the ticket. So Republicans appear to be in a really good place here with the Republican National Convention set to get underway in Milwaukee here on Monday. How important is that convention for messaging for Republicans, given the current chaos surrounding Joe Biden and all the issues that are out there? We're going to actually get back to talking about the economy and illegal immigration and those sorts of things.
Well, messaging is incredibly important. We've seen it in the past, how the Democrats have sort of run circles around the Republicans. And right now, the Biden administration, the Capitol Hill Democrats, they are all taking incoming from the press corps as it relates to the competency of President Biden. And you've seen the press secretary get a little combative with the press corps over there in the White House. You've also seen Hollywood begin to turn its back on President Biden. George Clooney wrote a major editorial for the New York Times this week where he called on Biden to do the right thing to save democracy and step aside. And here he is 3 weeks earlier hosting a historic fundraiser alongside Barack Obama for Joe Biden. And so you got people like him and John Lovitz and other Democrats on the Hill that are starting to say, we really need a new nominee, and does take a lot of the attention away from what President Trump and the Republicans want to do. So to be able to reclaim that with a positive agenda and really showing and demonstrating competency from not only Trump, but our deep Republican bench during this convention in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which also I think is really important because Wisconsin is a swing state. It's going to be a lot of fun. And conventions are typically pretty fun. I think when you compare this Republican convention with what the Democrats are going to have in roughly 6 weeks, you're going to see a stark contrast in terms of an aging, dying party like the Democrats have, and then compared with a lot of youth and excitement that the America First message brings over on the Republican side.
It certainly is going to be very fascinating over the next 6 or 7 weeks with both the party national conventions taking place, all the drama surrounding President Biden and the Republican vice presidential pick. We will track all of this over the coming weeks with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, a few words, please, about the club.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. It's a group that's united in the idea of economic freedom, opportunity, and liberty. You can check us out at clubforgrowth.org and learn more about what we're up to help save our economy.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thanks for being here.
You're welcome, Loman.
Federal regulators not only want to control every aspect of human behavior, now they want to plant RFID chips in every cow in the country. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns more from Jared Dieterol of the R Street Institute.
I'm not naive about the extent of government surveillance, but you know what? I had to shake my head when I saw this. Federal government now wants to track cows. Yes, just about every cow in the country. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Jared Dieterol. He is a resident senior fellow at the R Street Institute. He's been a regular guest with us here on the show, and he's the author of a new piece you can find at Reason.com, The Government Wants to Track Your Steak. Jared, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So this is about a new rule from the USDA. They're going to require RFID chips in most cows in the country. We have a lot of cows in this country.
Yeah, we do. And it's maybe a surprise to people in the Northeast Corridor, but we do have a huge ranching culture and industry in America. And yeah, they want to put these things called radio frequency ID tags, just kind of like a fancy word for a remote scanner, essentially, and it kind of will just track location and keep data on the weight, what farms the cows have been to, and anyone that travels in interstate commerce as part of market will be subject to this.
So I guess before we get to some of the issues here, explain to me the USDA's justification for this. Is like they were just bored, they didn't know what else they could regulate, so they came up with something new? Like what was the idea here originally?
Interestingly, when I looked into this, it turns out this is something they've been thinking about for a while, and they actually recommended doing this voluntarily for a while. The uptake was pretty low, which we can get into. It's because the tags don't work great or have great retention rates in a lot of cases. But yeah, they thought about doing it voluntarily. They finally decided that they're going to make it mandatory. And while I was digging around, there's already been some preliminary research internally at USDA about even potentially at some point moving to GPS tracking cows. So it's going to potentially get even more intense. Justification is public health, as it so often is with government things. And the idea is that if you track cows, it will be easier to trace and more quickly eradicate potential disease, livestock diseases like the mad cow and hoof and mouth. Of course, the interesting thing is that, first of all, we haven't had hoof and mouth disease in America in like over a century, but the mad cow, everyone kind of points to that 2003 outbreak that we had. And I was looking into that too, and it took 13 days to trace that cow to the origin farm. And I'm sitting here thinking, man, like look at like the trouble with the COVID origins. And so 13 days is pretty fast. So it's just kind of like a silly justification when you actually look at the reality and the facts.
Yeah, I remember vaguely that panic in 2003 over the mad cow outbreak. Simpler times, I think, back then when we worried about stuff like that. That seems, at least, there's some sort of plausible rationale there about public health. Is this, but I mean, you, as you write in the piece for Reason, I mean, this sort of fails on its own terms. I mean, like the logic underpinning this doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, first of all, like they create carve-outs inevitably, or effectively carve-outs for things called group tagging, which mostly would help large ranches. Like if all the cows are born in a group in the same farm, then they can just be tagged as a group, you know, like one cow in the group. And that completely undermines the idea of tracking the individual cows. And it's particularly silly because all the disease outbreaks that have happened have been at larger farms. It's, you know, the small guys that are doing the organic farming is not really where the concern is for disease outbreaks. So it really fails on its own terms. And again, we've had a lot of success eradicating diseases without this before. So it kind of double fails for that rationale.
We're talking with Jarrett Dieterol. He's a resident senior fellow at the R Street Institute and the author of a piece you can find at reason.com right now. The headline on that is "The Government Wants to Track Your Steak." Jarrett, I just want to, in the final minute here, kind of underline what you were just talking about there. This seems like typical Washington bureaucrat solution to a problem that doesn't really exist because, you know, for people who maybe haven't spent a lot of time on ranches, all cows are already tagged. I mean, the ranchers have an incentive to do that. They use these metal tags on the cows, on their ears. This is just new upgraded technology to replicate something that's already been taken care of, that's already handled and probably already mandated in other parts of the law.
Oh, it's only a Washington, D.C. bureaucrat could do. They failed to actually understand how ranching works. And the ranchers, by and large, don't like these tags because they're really hard to even just like visually see, and they tend to like fall off much more than regular tags. And so there's been just the reality is that it just leads to double tagging. They have to have the traditional metal tags and now these extra tags. So it just doubles the investment, and it's expensive to implement the technology for this. You know, you need scanners, all different kinds of things. And so completely lost, I think, on the DC bureaucrats there, but the ranchers themselves, it's pretty impractical for their day to day.
Yeah, of course, regulators always want to regulate, and the government wants to track anything that moves or moves, as you put it in that piece for us. Jarrett, thanks for taking some time and talking to us about this small, but I think pretty ridiculous example of government regulation.
Absolutely, Eric. Thanks.
And that is Jarrett Dieterol. He's a resident senior fellow at the R Street Institute. Check out their work. They do lots of fine work on a variety of topics at rstreet.org. Check out his latest piece at reason.com. Once again, the government wants to track your steak. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Baim. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Looking for a threat to democracy? Look no further than the potential impact of artificial intelligence. Dr. Paul Kengor, editor-in-chief of the American Spectator, has this American Radio Journal commentary.
We've recently seen multiple stories involving the two leading presidential candidates, Joe Biden and Donald Trump, that signal the rising dangers of the misuse of AI, that is, artificial intelligence, during an intense campaign season. Now, the examples of this run from alleged misinformation and video distortion to flat-out false imagery. And if maybe your eyes glaze over or your ears when you hear the phrase AI, well, hear me out. Think about it. AI can be used to produce bogus human voices, imagery, text, and video. It can be used to create some of the very worst fake news. And to that end, one shudders to think how AI might be abused during an election campaign, or worse, the very morning of a presidential election. The destructive potential is significant. As an example of that potential with the president, researchers at the University of Washington and MIT have created fake voice and video imagery of Barack Obama. The MIT case really struck me because the video purports to show Obama endorsing the MIT professor's computer course. And that made me think, What if a Republican fraudster produced on the morning of November 5th, 2024, video of a fake Obama endorsing, say, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. instead of Joe Biden, with the intent of pulling votes from Biden that day? Sure, the Biden campaign would grab Obama and scramble to denounce the video as phony, but perhaps not before the video went viral and cost Biden crucial votes. Potential to damage the two leading candidates actually swings both ways. In fact, that brings me to Donald Trump. Trump recently talked to podcaster Logan Paul about AI. Trump noted that he was recently presented with a fake video of him promoting a product, allegedly. The fake was so professionally done that Trump himself couldn't tell that it was a forgery. Trump told Logan Paul that this technology is downright scary because of the national security implications. He imagined fabricated imagery of a sitting U.S. president asserting that, quote, 13 nuclear missiles, unquote, had just been launched against an adversary and would strike in 13 minutes. Trump told Logan Paul that he had asked Elon Musk if an adversary like China or Russia could immediately know that, quote, that's not really President Trump who launched those missiles. Musk told him, no, there's no way. Now, those are Donald Trump's hypothetical scenarios. But now imagine this one concerning Trump in the 2024 campaign. We now know that the claims by liberals that Donald Trump in 2016 colluded with Vladimir Putin to steal the 2016 election from Hillary Clinton were fraudulent. The whole Russia dossier narrative was a nasty hoax. We also knew that exposing that scam took years and millions of dollars in federal government time and money, with the Mueller report eventually exonerating Trump. But imagine this. Picture a fake video of Donald Trump generated by liberals or by foreign adversaries on the morning of the November 5th, 2024 vote. Imagine fake video connecting Trump to Putin and the Ruskies in some sort of collusion. This would be the Russian dossier on steroids. Imagine that the video hits, explodes, and goes viral that morning. As voters head to the polls and CNN and the Drudge Report and MSNBC report what's actually fake news. Trump denies it as fake news as quickly as he can, but millions of Americans don't believe him. And more significant, they cast votes before Trump could possibly disprove the video. Now, that's a November surprise that could swing an election. And don't put it past Trump's adversaries to do this, nor past the Chinese or the Russians. In fact, it's the latter, the Russians, who wrote the manual on desinformatsia, the Russian word for disinformation. As for liberals, they equate Trump with Hitler. Like the French resistance during World War II, they do whatever it takes to take out this dictator who will destroy democracy. Trump supporters since 2020 have been wary of how his enemies might manipulate a presidential election. But they've been thinking of traditional ways like voter fraud and ballot stuffing, or maybe massive mail-in balloting. But the newest, slickest tool in the bag of tricks is AI. Is the Trump team ready? For that matter, is Team Biden ready? The threat swings both ways. If you want to see a genuine threat to democracy, folks, this is it. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WLFJ-AM in Greenville, South Carolina, KYND-AM in Belleville, Texas, along with WLNX-FM in Lincoln, Illinois. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.